Thank you for that, Ern. I know they're not easy names. I was just thinking to myself, I wonder what... Everybody has a shortened name. I always wondered what theirs were. So I'm glad you could make it out. It was minus 26 at our place this morning. I don't know if some of you may have beat that, if you live in low areas. I think on a morning like this, you probably find ice caps in your coffee in the morning, I would think. So we're looking at Daniel chapter 2 today. Now, the passage that Ernie read was just a bit of a preamble, some of the background from previous messages. So I wanted to start this morning with a few housekeeping duties for students of Scripture. And I just wanted to point out three things that I find are really helpful in the reading of the book of Daniel. Three things that make it just a bit easier to understand if you're in your study. So, the very first thing, and this is very helpful, okay, slide number one, is the book of Daniel has a key verse. So if you've got your Bibles in front of you, the key verse, I believe, of the book of Daniel is Daniel chapter 4, verse 17. Now this is really... Oh, it's not on. Okay. You know what? This is in your bulletin as well. I've got the three helpful hints in the bulletin. But Daniel chapter 4, verse 17... It's really handy. There's only a few books in the Bible that I know of have summary verses. It seems to me in John 20:21 is the summary verse. Last week I read from Ecclesiastes, the sum of the matter. Solomon said, the sum of the matter is this, fear God and keep His commandments. That's a key verse. So it makes no difference what my difficulties are in the book of Daniel. If I can always go back to that one verse and be reminded of what I need to know of the book of Daniel. The summary of 4:17 is embedded in the dream of Nebuchadnezzar concerning his pride before God. It's interesting that we would pray for world leaders. This guy was a world leader who humbled himself before God at one point. Verse 17, this, and I in NASB, 4:17 says, this sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers. And in context, the sentence against you, Nebuchadnezzar, which was a sentence to suffer dementia for a period of time and be put out to pasture, so to speak. This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is the command of the holy ones. And in order, and here's the point of the book of Daniel, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom He wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men, the most humble of men. And in context, that's Nebuchadnezzar. So that's the key verse in the book of Daniel. Second helpful hint to me. In general, the book of Daniel is divided into two portions. The first half, and this is traditionally the Jewish division of it, the first half, chapters 1 to 6, is historical in nature. And the second half, 7 to 12, are the visions of Daniel and are considered prophetic in nature. Even though chapter 2 is quite prophetic. What's distinctive about 7 to 12 is these are the visions of Daniel himself. So the first half is history, the last half is prophecy. And that always helps me in my division because of the third helpful hint. The third helpful hint is that because of this division of history in the first half, and prophecy in the second half, it is not in chronological order. if you want to make more sense of the sequence of events in Daniel, you want to know what the chronological sequence of the chapters is, and it makes it a lot easier to understand once in a while to read it in those in that order. So, chapters, and in your bulletin, chapters 1 to 4 come first, then chapter 7 and 8, then chapter 5, chapter 9, well, 9 to 12, actually. That's the actual sequence of events. And it's very helpful. Ezekiel's the same. It's not written in chronological order either. It's divided up differently. So, and the events of Daniel were not intended, or the book of Daniel was not intended to be written as a historical sequence, and that's why it's not written that way. So, a few weeks back, we looked at Daniel chapter 1, and of course the reading was from Daniel chapter 1. And to review a little, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon had made three campaigns into Judah and to Jerusalem, beginning in 604 B.C., and progressing over about an 18-year period. It was in the first campaign, 604, in the third year of King Jehoiakim, that the Babylonians took captive the royal family and noble families, and a number of others, including Daniel and the other three heroes of that time, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who were assigned Babylonian names that we now know of as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And of course, we find that they did not live up to their Babylonian names, but rather their Hebrew names, which spoke of the glory of God. In chapter 1, verses 17 and 18, it says of them that at the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with him, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. I've pictured in my mind that this reference to 10 times better may have come from a comment from the king. I could hear him saying something like, "These guys are 10 times better than those other clowns." We noted in chapter 1 how noble these men were, likely still teenagers, most likely, and how they risked their own lives to be so, in not complying with the Babylonian rules about food placed upon them, even though they were considered property of Babylon. And they were captives and they were exiles. I think I may have mentioned that they probably actually found, having grown up with kosher food and having been born in the time of Josiah with all of the restoration of the old system and the kosher food, that they probably found Babylonian food actually disgusting. And a lot of it was considered delicacy in a lot of king's palaces to leave the blood in the meat. And so things like that would have actually disgusted them. Now, let's just look at Daniel chapter 2, if you want to turn to that. And we'll go through this verse by verse a bit. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep went from him. Is that verse 1 or verse 2? I don't have it written here. But anyways, I'll just stop there. I'm a little troubled by the reference of the second year of his reign, just to let you know. I have troubles reconciling that a little bit with the timing of the first wave of the exiles. But however you look at it, this dream really happens very early in Daniel's career as a captive. So it's early in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He's just starting. It's early in Daniel, and the other three have just been taken captive within those 2 years. Daniel and his friends are not in Babylon long before Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. It's hard to know how drawn out the story is. It's deceptively easy to read. It only takes us a couple minutes. But it may have been played out over weeks or months or even a couple of years. And I say this because I know that the first campaign of Nebuchadnezzar into Judah until the complete fall of Jerusalem was around 18 or 19 years. So this event is many years before the fall of Jerusalem, probably 16 or 17 years. So one should understand that even though it's early in the actual reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar served with his father previously, the king of Babylon, for some time, and he took the kingdom after his father had died. His father, Nabopolassar, died, it seems, while Nebuchadnezzar was fighting Egypt just after the death of King Josiah of Judah. And Daniel and his three friends, I think, would have been born in the latter part of Josiah's reign. At any rate, it's early in Daniel's time there and early in Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Verse 2. Then the king gave orders to call the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. The king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. "O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation." The king replied to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation." They answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation." The king replied, "I know for certain you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm, that if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh." Because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. So, verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar dreams, and he's quite upset. And I was thinking about the protocols of meeting with an Eastern king. This king with his father, had taken in war, just previous to this, Assyria, Judah, and I believe both Upper and Lower Egypt. He was a sovereign. If you needed audience with this man for some reason, there would have been an application process and special permissions to be granted. And at that, if he didn't like you, you could be enslaved or put to death or maybe something worse. This was that kind of a man. I think it's funny, actually, that God follows no procedure in this manner. The God of heaven not only marches into the king's bedroom, but goes right into Nebuchadnezzar's dreams and doesn't even identify himself. God steals his mind and his sleep away from him. The upset of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, when you think of it, seems a bit understated. We all here know what it is to have unsettling dreams, and maybe dreams that terrify us and alter our perception of reality sometimes for days or for weeks. This is an extremely upsetting dream to Nebuchadnezzar. The nature of it is such that he knows that this dream is bigger than life and bigger than him. And I think it does terrify him. I think God pushes all of his buttons to make sure he's disturbed. And God terrifies him with it. I think last week I mentioned this matter of, you know, of splitting atoms. You know, so now we have known for a long time you can split an atom and melt down central Alberta with the splitting of that atom. And the fact that God has put so much energy into matter that it's incomprehensible. We don't even know why he does that. And there was something about this dream where Nebuchadnezzar probably had a good feel for how much energy was in it. This was a dream about kingdoms and nations and the future, and God gave it to him, and it rattled him right to his bones. This is seen in his resolve to discover its truth. He seems to have some sense that he cannot discern or discover the meaning of it by himself, and that he needs help. It's an interesting perception. The reference to the magicians and conjurers and the Chaldeans is a reference to the trained individuals like Daniel who were schooled in the culture and training available to those who worked in the ruling civil service close to and in the palace. This would have included spiritism and magic arts, astrology, contact with the dead and the gods, and the like, besides other disciplines which included language, likely culture, science, mathematics, all of that. The reference to the Chaldeans themselves seems to be to refer to citizens of Babylon as opposed to captives, like Daniel, who were not slaves, but on payroll as advisors and administrators to the king, but also holding credentials in spiritual matters such as foretelling the future, manipulating the future, especially in matters of war, and interpreting dreams. And so Nebuchadnezzar, in some desperation, goes to this group. I made reference to him saying that he found the Hebrew youth 10 times better than the others. At this point in his anxiety, he seems to have forgotten them, and they are not present in this meeting. But I think likely the original reference to them being 10 times better is the possible hint, not absolute, but possible, that Nebuchadnezzar held the rest of this class of people in suspicion and in some disdain. He has come to them afraid and absolutely determined to sift out whether or not they can actually help. The narrative shows how harshly pragmatic he is, and that's mentioned later on in Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. If they cannot do their jobs, they are of no utility to him. He will simply have them destroyed. Why should they take up space and food? Why should they take up space on the payroll? He has destroyed whole nations. And who are these useless people to him? All he wants is to have his dream interpreted. Is that so unreasonable when one is surrounded by so many spiritual people? Some of you think you've had tough employers. So I hope you caught what the text said. Nebuchadnezzar did not tell his dream to anyone. He expected his staff to tell him what dream he had and then explain its meaning. They're the ones with the tarot cards, so to speak, the Ouija boards and the connection to the dead, the expertise in astrology, and otherwise the top intellectuals and advisors of the East. So nothing should be unreasonable to request. So that's where it's at. In anger and fear, Nebuchadnezzar sends orders to gather that class of people together, the citizens, the captives, whatever, and have them destroyed. He's frustrated. He wants none of it. If they cannot be of any use, they will be punished. Verse 14. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, "For what reason is the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men in Babylon. This portion of the account speaks to the great respect that authorities had for Daniel. Remember, Daniel's quite young. We don't know what his age is, but he's likely a teenager. He might be 15 or 18, we don't know. He might even be 20. But he's young, and he speaks out. But they had great authority, and Arioch, the head of security, had enough respect for him to hear him out. And further, it says, the account seems to indicate that Daniel could actually request time from the king himself. Now, remember, the king said, "You guys are trying to buy time, and I'm not going to let you." But when Daniel asks for time, the king gives it to him, even though the king had denied the entire group as a whole any time to consider the matter. Chapter 1, verse 9, it says that God had granted Daniel favor in the sight of all of the officials in the palace. So God is orchestrating every detail and the timing of it all, regardless of how it appeared on a human level. And speaking of a human level, Daniel did not know the dream. He took the matter back to his friends, and they together asked God for help, just like we would have to do, each one of us. And I can't imagine their emotions as they went through this process. Verse 19, Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." Therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king." Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king." The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" Then Daniel answered before the king and said, "As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream, and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, that you may understand the thoughts of your mind." Now, most of this is self-explanatory, but I wish to point out just how detailed Daniel's response is. Daniel seems to me to be a teacher, and he's acting as an envoy of the living God. Now, if it was me, I would be blurting the dream all over the place and its contents. Not Daniel. He's very controlled, and he's instructive. He follows protocols, attempting to make Nebuchadnezzar understand the nature of what is happening to him. God has called Nebuchadnezzar the ruler of the eastern world, the new ruler of the eastern world, to a business meeting on matters of mutual interest to both the God of heaven and Nebuchadnezzar. And by the way, the term God of heaven, as I recall, is only mentioned in the book of Daniel. It's only there that God is called the God of heaven. I mentioned some weeks ago that in the book of Jeremiah, God refers to Nebuchadnezzar as my servant. That was back before Nebuchadnezzar had come to power, but when he was commanding the military under his father, Nabopolassar. To our knowledge, Nebuchadnezzar did not know about that reference and would certainly have been insulted to have been referred to as the servant of anybody, especially a servant of the God of Israel. A servant might be highly respected, but in general, if you said to a servant, "Do this," then the servant would do that. If you said to the servant, do that, well, it happened. God said, Nebuchadnezzar is my servant, even before Nebuchadnezzar had any real knowledge of God at all. So, this is the precious moment. God has called Nebuchadnezzar to a matter as one would call a servant. Nebuchadnezzar is called. He has no choice in the matter. He is compelled to do so, and he will be expected to hear what God has to say to him. The dream is given as to a servant, and God will expect Nebuchadnezzar to follow some instructions down the road. However, as I said, the content of the dream is about matters of mutual interest to both Nebuchadnezzar and to God. So, for today, I didn't want to go any further because it's going to take some time to go through the dream itself. But to be specific, as we look at the dream, if you read it this week in Daniel chapter 2, the matters of mutual interest are matters that involve time. God is concerned about kingdoms. Nebuchadnezzar is concerned about kingdoms. God is concerned about people. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is concerned about people, although not in the same way. God is concerned about sovereignty. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is very interested in sovereignty. Nebuchadnezzar is a collector of cultures and people and languages, and he's also a collector of information. Well, God is interested in all of that as well. So, most importantly, as we will see down the road, Nebuchadnezzar is concerned, and it comes out in the dream if you are looking at the details. Nebuchadnezzar is concerned about an enduring kingdom, a kingdom that will last. And that's what this dream deals with, is the concept not just of the kingdom of God versus the kingdom of men, but an enduring kingdom. And that's what God is dealing with Nebuchadnezzar in this dream. So, God is going to work Nebuchadnezzar over pretty thoroughly in the matter. So next week I want to look at the dream as it's expressed and presented in Scripture.